population. Take the population, divide by 100, then take the square root of the result. Why? Because math. In fact, the number used to be 1% of the population, but then, after failing to reach the number needed to affect the world, they, quote, discovered that the real number was only the square root of 1%. Apparently, there isn't a dose-response effect. There is a threshold effect, and once you get over the magic threshold, the effect kicks in. That threshold has a simple mathematical formula, which makes it sound all sciencey. There's no established theoretical reason for this. It has more in common with a magic ritual and numerology than a scientific process. The real world is not base 10. That is only a human convention. There's no reason why any natural constant would involve such a round number as 1%. This is what they claim to have done for the experiment. They tracked the murder rate in the 206 largest U.S. cities where FBI murder statistics were available. They then compared the baseline period from 2002 to 2006 with the intervention period from 2007 to 2010. The intervention period was when the Transcendental Meditation and TM Siddhi group exceeded 1,725 participants beginning in January 2007. They claim that murder rates were increasing before that date, but then when participant number 1,725, because 1,724 was not enough, signed up, the rate started to drop. What's really funny is the blatant frequentist, basing conclusions solely on statistics, nonsense they spout in the press release. They claim to have, quote, calculated that the probability that the reduced trend in murder rates could simply be due to chance was 1 in 10 million million. So they think the probability that the murder rate declined from 2007 to 2010 due to chance was 1 in a trillion. This is an excellent example of ways to bias the outcome precisely because it tries really hard to have all the form of a serious scientific study, despite the fact that they are essentially studying magic. The reality is that crime and homicide rates were dropping for the previous 40 years. The decrease shown in the study was just a continuation of a long-term trend. In addition, they chose an arbitrary study period. Why 2002 to 2006? And an arbitrary follow-up period. In fact, during the follow-up period, the number of meditators dropped below the magic number at times. There are so many arbitrary choices in this research that you can make the numbers say whatever you want. You see, this time, the robot who loses his head wins. You can then scrub the resulting write-up to make it seem all perfectly legitimate. This is what we call torturing the data until they confess. The problem with p-values. There are many things that can go wrong with a scientific study, but perhaps chief among them is, quote, p-hacking. The term derives from the statistical calculation known as the p-value. The p-value is just one way to look at scientific data. It first assumes a specific null hypothesis, such as, there is no correlation between these two variables, and then asks, what is the probability that the data would be at least as extreme as they are if the null hypothesis were true? A p-value of 0.05, a typical threshold for being considered, quote, significant, indicates a 5% probability that the data are due to chance rather than a real effect. Except, that's not actually true. That is how most people interpret the p-value, but that's not what it actually says. P-values don't consider many other important variables like prior probability, effect size, confidence intervals, and alternative hypotheses. For example, if we ask, what is the probability of a new set of data replicating the results of a study with a p-value of 0.05? We get a very different answer. In a Nature commentary on this problem, Regina Nuzzo reports, these are sticky concepts, but some statisticians have tried to provide general rule-of-thumb conversions. See, quote, probable cause. According to one widely used calculation, a p-value of 0.01 corresponds to a false alarm probability of at least 11%. depending on the underlying probability that there is a true effect. A p-value of 0.05 raises that chance to at least 29%. So Model's finding had a greater than 1 in 10 chance of being a false alarm. Likewise, the probability of replicating his original result was not 99%, as most would assume, but something closer to 73%, or only 50%, if he wanted another very significant result. In other words, his inability to replicate the result was about as surprising as if he had called heads on a coin toss and it had come up tails. Let me restate that. A study with a p-value of 0.01 may have only a 50% chance in an exact replication of producing another p-value of 0.01, not the 99% chance that most people would assume. Put another way, people, even experienced scientists, tend to think of the p-value as a predictive value, but it isn't. It was never meant to be. It's only a smell test to see if the data are at all interesting or just random noise. Here is an example from medicine I often use in my lectures. Let's say that 1% of 40-year-old women have breast cancer. Let us further say that mammograms are 80% sensitive. They will come out positive 80% of the time with patients who actually have breast cancer. They are also 90% specific. They will be negative 90% of the time with patients who do not have breast cancer. These numbers are pretty good for a screening test. Here is the question. What is the predictive value of a positive mammogram in a 40-year-old woman? Or what are the odds that she actually has breast cancer because her mammogram was positive? With a 90% specificity, you might be tempted to say 90%, but that would be wrong. The real answer is 7.5%. This is because 99 out of 100 40-year-old women do not have breast cancer. So with a 10% false positive rate, there will be about 10 women out of 100 who test positive but don't have breast cancer. Only about 0.8 of the 1 in 100 women who have breast cancer will test positive. So, out of 100 women, 9.9 will test positive but be negative, and 0.8 will test positive and be positive. So if you are a 40-year-old woman and test positive, chances are much greater it's a false positive. 0.8 true positive divided by 10.7 total positive times 100 equals 7.5%. This situation is analogous to the p-value. Having a p-value of 0.05 does not mean there is a 95% chance the hypothesis is true, any more than a positive mammogram in a 40-year-old woman means there is a 90% chance she has breast cancer. Just as with breast cancer, you have to know what the base rate is. We also call this the prior probability. With a scientific hypothesis, this often means the scientific plausibility. The lower the plausibility, just like the lower the rate of cancer in the population, the smaller the percentage of positive or statistically significant studies will be true positives. This means that we can't know the probability that a hypothesis is true just from the p-value of one study. We need to know the plausibility of the hypothesis, and we need to know what all the other relevant studies showed. We call this a Bayesian approach. You take the new information, you add it to the prior existing information, and you come up with a new probability that the idea is true. While it's possible to debate about how plausible a hypothesis is, one thing is clear. P-values, statistical significance, don't mean nearly as much as most people think they do. Even a significant study doesn't alter the prior probability by that much. It takes a convergence of multiple studies and multiple independent lines of evidence before we can be confident that a hypothesis is likely to be true. If we apply this reasoning to the scientific literature, as statistician and professor of medicine John P. A. Ioannidis has done, we find that most published positive studies are, and should be, wrong. As he demonstrated in his seminal 2005 study, if we assume that 80% of new hypotheses in science are wrong, which is a conservative assumption, and we use a p-value of 0.05, then by chance alone, 25% of positive studies will be false positive. This number increases dramatically as the prior probability goes down. Prior probability isn't the only factor that worsens the false positive problem. Eric Loken and Andrew Gelman point out that measurement error also greatly exacerbates the problem. This is why we consider the signal-to-noise ratio in whatever is being measured in a scientific study. In a noisy environment, measurement errors are magnified, and the predictive value of a p-value plummets. Noisy data are exactly that. It's like listening to a radio station with so much static, the noise, you can barely make out the announcer's voice, the signal. This could just mean that the natural variability in the data is far greater than the effect you are looking for. P-hacking. The problem goes even deeper, and this is where p-hacking comes in. Ioannidis' calculations assume that research protocols are perfectly designed and executed, that everyone is playing by the rules, but we know this isn't the case. In a 2011 study, Joseph Simmons, Leif Nelson, and Uri Simonsen revealed the effects of exploiting, quote, researcher degrees of freedom. This means choosing when to stop recording data, what variables to follow, which comparisons to make, and which statistical methods to use, all decisions that researchers have to make about every study. If, however, they monitor the data or the outcomes in any way while making these decisions, they can consciously or unconsciously exploit their degrees of freedom to reach the magic p-value of 0.05. In fact, Simmons showed you can reach a p-value of 0.05 60% of the time with completely negative data. Simonsen points out that p-values in published papers cluster suspiciously around the 0.05 level, implying that researchers were engaging in p-hacking until they reached this minimal publishable threshold. There is more direct evidence that p-hacking is taking place. A 2009 PLOS One review found that 33% of surveyed researchers admitted to committing one or more dubious practices. What dubious practices? Those that amount to p-hacking. It's likely that most p-hacking is innocent, meaning that the researchers don't realize they're essentially cheating. For example, if you survey the data as you collect it, you might decide that once you cross over the p equals 0.05 threshold, you can stop collecting data and publish. Tracking the data isn't in itself dubious and is often required in medical studies to make sure subjects are not being harmed. But this kind of tracking should be done independently of the primary investigator who is gathering the data to publish. Or at the very least, the number of subjects needs to be determined ahead of time and not altered by monitoring the data as they come in. Essentially, anything a researcher changes about the research after looking at data can be p-hacking. That's because it alters these statistics. P-hacking is essentially mining the data or taking multiple throws of the dice and only counting the results you like. Another way in which much of what is published doesn't reflect reality comes from the problem with replications. Independent replications really are the ultimate arbiters of what is real in science. Any one study can be a fluke or the product of biased research. Only phenomena that are real, however, should show up in the data no matter who is doing the research. Exact replications are particularly useful because by definition, they eliminate all the degrees of freedom. All the choices about collecting and analyzing the data have already been made by the study being replicated. There are many who think there is currently a replication problem in science. In a 2016 study published in Nature, 52% of scientists surveyed reported this belief based on their own inability to replicate the work of others. There have been several largely unsuccessful and now famous attempts to replicate seminal studies in psychology and elsewhere. In one 2015 attempt involving 100 psychological studies, only 39 were deemed to have been successfully replicated. The problem isn't confined to psychology, but as discussed previously, fields like psychology and medicine, which are noisy in terms of measuring outcomes, meaning the data are inherently variable, will tend to have higher false positive rates. Remember our friend Daryl Bem? The problem with his psi research is that he was engaging in p-hacking, In fact, in a 2017 interview, Bem essentially admitted that he engages in research techniques designed to comb through data looking for an effect. "I'm all for rigor," he continued, "but I prefer other people do it. I see its importance. It's fun for some people, but I don't have the patience for it." It's been hard for him, he said, to move into a field where the data count for so much. "If you looked at all my past experiments, they were always rhetorical devices. I gathered data to show how my point would be made. I used data as a point of persuasion, and I never really worried about will this replicate or will this not." Bem could not resist p-hacking to rescue his failed psi experiment. He changed the rules specifically to make him the winner, and the scientific community looked at him the same way my daughter looked at her cousin. Nice try, Bem. The fix. The problems with both p-hacking and overusing the p-value are all fixable. One important fix, as just discussed, is valuing exact replications more. Value is easy to determine in science. What gets published, what gets funded, and what gets you academically promoted. Statistician Andrew Gelman of Columbia University suggests that researchers should do research in several steps. First, collect preliminary data and, if they look promising, design a replication where all the decisions about the data collection are predetermined. Then register the study methods before collecting any data. Finally, collect a fresh set of data according to the published methods. At least then we'll have honest p-values and eliminate p-hacking. Researchers should not rely only on p-values. They should also report effect sizes and confidence intervals, which are more thorough ways of looking at the data. Tiny effect sizes, a one-week cold was reduced on average by 1 hour, wow, no matter how significant, are always dubious because subtle but systematic biases, errors, or unknown factors can influence the results. Simonson advocates researchers disclosing everything they do, all decisions about data collection and analysis. This way, at least they cannot hide their p-hacking, and the disclosure will discourage the practice. Nuzzo and others recommend more use of Bayesian analysis, which we discussed previously, asking, what is the overall probability that this effect is real? Where do we stand? Looking past all the math, what all of this means for the average science enthusiast or for the science-based practitioner is that you have to look beyond the p-values when evaluating any new scientific study or claim. Also, look for p-hacking when sizing up scientific research. Did the researchers have any wiggle room to change the rules as needed to get the results they wanted? We can still get to a high degree of confidence that a phenomenon is real. This is what it takes for research to be convincing. 1. Rigorous studies that appear to minimize the effect of bias or unrelated variables. 2. Results that are not only statistically significant, but are significant in effect size as well, reasonable signal-to-noise ratio. 3. A pattern of independent replication consistent with a real phenomenon. 4. Evidence proportional to the plausibility of the claim. What we often see from proponents of various pseudosciences or dubious claims is the trumpeting of one or two of these features, but never all four, or even the first three. They showcase the impressive p-values, but ignore the tiny effect sizes or the lack of replication, for example. Homeopathy, acupuncture, and ESP research are all plagued by these deficiencies. They haven't produced research results anywhere near the threshold of acceptance. Their studies reek of p-hacking. They generally have tiny effect sizes, and there is no consistent pattern of replication, just chasing different quirky results. Yet there is no clean dichotomy between science and pseudoscience, that pesky demarcation problem. Yes, there are those claims that are far toward the pseudoscience end of the spectrum, but all of these problems plague mainstream science as well. P-hacking leads to a tremendous waste of scientific resources. It's incredibly inefficient, flooding the literature with spurious results that probably won't be replicated. It's also almost entirely ignored when reporting science to the public. All the public hears is, scientists report a significant result. but most of what gets relayed as excited scientific breakthroughs is simply crap cluttering up the scientific journals. Chapter 25. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Conspiracy Theories. A conspiracy theory, or more precisely, a grand conspiracy, is a belief system that involves at its core the claim that a vast, powerful group is carrying out a deception against the public for their own nefarious ends. The government kinda sucks at keeping secrets. Bill Nye. Conspiracy thinking is arguably the confluence of many of the logical fallacies and cognitive biases that we have already discussed. In many ways, it's the, quote, one ring to rule them all of faulty thinking. Conspiracy thinking crops up in just about every topic skeptics deal with. It is an all-purpose get-out-of-jail-free card played whenever a true believer's back is up against the wall, an attempt to flip the table over when you are losing the game. I have also referred to the conspiracy theory as the last refuge of the intellectual scoundrel. And yet conspiracy theories remain stubbornly common. Let's take a peek inside to see if we can figure out why. The Grand Conspiracy. When we talk about conspiracies or conspiracy theories, we're generally referring to what is also called the, quote, grand conspiracy. This term differentiates the big crazy conspiracies from more mundane and plausible conspiracies. No one doubts the existence of actual conspiracies. Whenever two people get together and agree to work together to perpetrate a crime, that's a conspiracy. There are many conspiracies that exist at the boardroom level, the inner circle of one company or one government agency. A grand conspiracy is much bigger. This is a conspiracy that by its very nature must span many people and organizations, perhaps even multiple nations and generations. The grand conspiracy forms a triangle of sorts. First, there are the conspirators. This is typically a large, powerful, and shadowy organization with vast resources and control. They need to be powerful in order to fake moon landings, poison the public through jet exhaust, or frame terrorists for 9/11. Then there are the conspiracy theorists, an army of light that is able to see through the conspiracy because they are just so clever. Finally, there is everyone else, the dupes or, quote, sheeple, who believe the standard explanation of history and current events. Conspiracy thinking. There's a certain flawed logic to conspiracy thinking that makes it both tantalizing and fatally flawed at the same time. The core problem with conspiracy thinking is that it's a closed belief system, specifically designed to insulate itself from external refutation or even the need for internal consistency. Conspiracy theories are often elaborate exercises in special pleading. Any evidence that can potentially falsify the conspiracy theory is just part of the conspiracy. To the conspiracy theorist, such evidence was obviously fabricated in order to maintain the conspiracy. So, whether it's a scientific study showing that vaccines are safe, high-resolution pictures showing that astronauts were on the moon, or evidence linking terrorists to 9/11, it's all fake. Any events that seem to contradict a conspiracy narrative were clearly a, quote, false flag operation. The government engineered the whole thing to throw the sheeple off track. Further, any evidence that we would expect to find to support the conspiracy but is missing is part of a cover-up. The conspirators are really good at covering their tracks. How good? As good as they need to be. The cover-up is where grand conspiracies tend to get into a death spiral of special pleading. No one has come forward to claim that they were part of the alleged government plan to control the population by releasing chemtrails from commercial jets. Why not? Because the government has the power to intimidate or silence any potential whistleblowers. If George Bush faked the terrorist attacks on 9/11, why didn't Democrats expose the conspiracy when they held the reins of power? They must have been in on it. Why hasn't the media exposed the conspiracy either? They must be in on it too. What about other governments, many of whom are our enemies? Take a wild guess. Any problems with the conspiracy can be solved by simply expanding it. Before long, you get to the belief that a worldwide shadow government controls everything. The Illuminati, reptilian overlords, the New World Order, and similar grand conspiracies. Not only does the breadth and scope of the conspiracy have to enlarge, but the power and cunning of the conspirators as well. For example, there's a common belief that, quote, they have the cure for cancer, but are hiding it from the public. Who are they exactly? This bit of imprecision hides many assumptions. Big Pharma is a likely answer, but that doesn't cut it. Individual pharmaceutical companies compete against each other, and new startups form all the time. What's stopping a new company from marketing an alleged cure? What about other countries? Who actually controls research? Most basic cancer research is government-funded and carried out by researchers at university labs. How would Big Pharma control this research? Papers are published in peer-reviewed journals, and researchers exchange knowledge routinely. Anything approaching a cure would be the result of dozens of labs, if not more, working over a period of years. Pharmaceutical companies get involved only in the last step, taking a possible new drug target and developing a workable pharmaceutical. Perhaps cancer doctors are the ones behind it all. The argument often goes that they want to keep patients coming. Well, the hospitals and clinicians don't control the research either. Since researchers' goals are to be famous and get grants, they don't care if clinicians make money. In any case, curing patients tends to be highly profitable. Allowing your customers to die isn't a good long-term strategy. Once you begin to see the entire system involving many people and institutions with different motives, the notion that there is a, quote, they that can control the whole thing for their own nefarious purposes becomes obviously absurd. No one has the power to hide something as big as a cure for cancer. While the conspirators are necessarily preternaturally large and powerful to pull off such elaborate conspiracies, they are simultaneously incredibly stupid in the ways they allegedly, quote, expose themselves to the conspiracy theorists. The conspirators are brilliant when the believers need them to be and careless when they need them to be. So they will stage sending astronauts to the moon and then allegedly allow a fan or open door to blow the flag to give away that it's not in a vacuum. Don't! Once the conspiracy narrative is adopted, it becomes a lens through which reality is viewed. Pattern recognition and hyperactive agency detection combine to form a tendency to see disparate events as connected, with an unseen agent behind them. Confirmation bias then kicks in. Every event, no matter how random or innocent, can become evidence for the conspiracy. Anomaly hunting feeds into this as well. Everything, even slightly unusual or unfamiliar, becomes an anomaly that proves the conspiracy. Every coincidence is part of the pattern. Conspiracy theorists also commit the fundamental attribution error, ascribing deliberate actions to others and ignoring the quirky external details of everyday life. For example, on November 24, 1963, Jack Ruby shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald on live television and in the presence of police officers. To conspiracy theorists, this was an obvious silencing. Why else would Ruby have done this? In Case Closed, however, Gerald Posner makes a convincing case that Ruby was a loser and a poser, a mobster wannabe, who was deeply disturbed by the killing of President Kennedy and wanted to be the man who killed the man who killed JFK. Yet conspiracy theorists easily impose their own narrative on his motivations. The ad hominem attack is also a common fallacy employed by the conspiracy theorists. If you question their elaborate conspiracy theory, then you are gullible and lack the vision to see events for what they are. If you point out the factual and logical problems with their case, then you're clearly part of the conspiracy. You are a shill, or part of an AstroTurf campaign, or even perhaps one of the Illuminati. Conspiracy theories are also often arguments from ignorance. Theorists point to apparent anomalies, coincidences, or things that don't make sense to their limited understanding, and then just ask questions. If you can't explain everything down to an arbitrary level of detail, there must be a conspiracy. They don't have to provide evidence for the conspiracy. They can just poke holes in the standard version of events. A 2012 study by Michael Wood, Karen Douglas, and Robbie Sutton showed that believers can accept mutually exclusive conspiracy theories at the same time. Belief that Princess Diana was murdered correlated with belief that she faked her death and was still alive. Belief that Osama bin Laden was already dead when the Navy SEALs got to his compound correlated with belief that he is still alive. Any conspiracy is acceptable, even those that contradict each other. Finally, the conspiracy theorists make tautological arguments, usually in the form of qui bono, who benefits. This is a reasonable question to ask when forming a hypothesis about an actual crime. Conspiracy theorists, however, will use it as evidence for a particular conspiracy. Every big event will have winners and losers. Those who come to power or may have gained in some way as a result of an historical event didn't necessarily cause it. Quote, "Don't be naive," the conspiracy theorist will say. "They gained, so of course they caused it to happen." Too big not to fail. A 2016 paper in PLOS ONE explores the mathematical probability of a grand conspiracy being revealed from within. The paper, of course, doesn't disprove any particular conspiracy theory, but it does make a compelling argument by putting into rigorous form a frequent case against grand conspiracies, that they're too big not to fail. The author of this paper, David Robert Grimes, writes about conspiracies as follows. Conspiratorial ideation is the tendency of individuals to believe that events and power relations are secretly manipulated by certain clandestine groups and organizations. Many of these ostensibly explanatory conjectures are non-falsifiable, lacking in evidence or demonstrably false, yet public acceptance remains high. Efforts to convince the general public of the validity of medical and scientific findings can be hampered by such narratives, which can create the impression of doubt or disagreement in areas where the science is well established. When conspiracies get very large, involving large numbers of people across multiple institutions and many years or even decades, this raises questions about the plausibility and logistics of orchestrating and maintaining such a conspiracy. Grand conspiracy theories tend to grow larger and more complex until they collapse under their own weight. In the PLOS ONE paper, Grimes set out to do a probability failure analysis of grand conspiracies. What's the probability that they will fail from within, meaning that someone who is in on the conspiracy either deliberately or accidentally exposes the conspiracy sufficiently that it fails? He didn't consider extrinsic failure, being exposed by outside investigation. Grimes used real historical conspiracies as his guide, namely the National Security Agency spying scandal, exposed by Edward Snowden, the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, and the FBI forensics scandal. In order to make a mathematical model of grand conspiracy failure, he had to plug in several factors. These include how many people would need to be involved in the conspiracy, how does that number change over time, and how reliable is each individual on average. From the historical examples, he came up with a range of reliability and then used the most reliable end of the spectrum for his calculations to come up with the most conservative estimate of failure probability. How the number of conspirators changed over time is an interesting variable. For some conspiracy theories, like the alien recovered from a crashed saucer at Roswell, the people involved at the time would die off over the years, reducing the number of people who can expose the conspiracy and decreasing the probability that this would happen. However, other conspiracies, such as covering up the alleged real risk of vaccines, would have a steady roster of people involved. This is because the conspiracy isn't just covering up a single historical event, but ongoing scientific research and the analysis of data. For his analysis, he used four grand conspiracies: the moon landing hoax, that climate change is fake, vaccines, and the hidden cancer cure. For each, he had to come up with some way of estimating the number of people necessarily involved in the conspiracy. I think his numbers are conservative, but others might argue that a small number of people could control the process. I disagree, especially whenever scientific data are involved. Any scientists with adequate training can look at the data and do their own analysis. For the moon landing, he used the peak total employment of NASA in 1964, which was 411,000 people. For the climate change hoax, he used the membership of scientific organizations that have backed the notion of AGW, resulting in 405,000 people. For vaccines, he used the total of those employed by the CDC and the World Health Organization, 22,000. He could have easily added the members of every pediatrics professional organization. For the hidden cancer cure, he used the employees of the major pharmaceutical companies, who numbered 714,000. You can, of course, quibble about these numbers. I think they're probably reasonable to an order of magnitude, which is all that matters for his analysis. Grimes' model predicts these grand conspiracies would intrinsically fail within about 4 years. Remember, he is using the most conservative estimates for individual reliability and dedication to the conspiracy. For average values, the conspiracies would fail much more quickly. Even if you think he's off by an order of magnitude involving tens of thousands of people, results still show a high probability of failure within a few years. You can adjust the variables, reliability, number of people involved, and the change in the number over time, to generate failure curves with his model. If you have several thousand highly reliable conspirators, you still get a fairly high probability of failure within decades, with more rapid failure as the conspiracy grows or reliability decreases. In short, grand conspiracies can only exist in a fantasy world. Author Dean Kuntz summarized it this way. The sane understand that human beings are incapable of sustaining conspiracies on a grand scale, because some of our most defining qualities as a species are inattention to detail, a tendency to panic, and an inability to keep our mouths shut. Who believes in conspiracies? While it seems that we each have a little conspiracy theorist inside us, there is definitely a spectrum when it comes to the tendency to engage in conspiracy thinking. There's a conspiracy bias, if you will, and many of us are at least a little prone to it. Most people are opportunistic conspiracy theorists. We tend to accept conspiracies ad hoc when it suits our beliefs. This is most obvious when it comes to political ideology. For example, a 2016 survey found that 17% of Clinton voters believed Clinton's emails made reference to a ring inside Washington providing child prostitutes for politicians, the so-called Pizzagate conspiracy. Meanwhile, 46% of Trump voters believe this. On the other hand, a 2013 survey by Public Policy Polling found that 29% of liberals believed or were uncertain that the Bush administration knowingly allowed 9/11 to happen, compared to only 15% of conservatives. Across the board, liberals and conservatives were more likely to accept a conspiracy if it was in line with their ideology. Meanwhile, for conspiracies without clear political implications, such as whether or not the government is covering up a crash saucer at Roswell, 21% overall believe this, or whether Paul McCartney was killed in 1966, 5% overall. Belief is roughly the same across the political spectrum. There's also no political difference when it comes to basic conspiracy ideology, such as the tendency to think that there are powerful secret forces at work in the world. However, the same surveys also find that a subset of the population appears to be general conspiracy theorists. They believe in most conspiracies regardless of the political implications. They believe in conspiracy theories because of a general tendency toward conspiracy thinking. Here are some common conspiracy theories with the percentage of believers, according to public policy polling. 20% of voters believe there is a link between childhood vaccines and autism. 46% do not. 7% of voters think the moon landing was faked. 13% of voters think Barack Obama is the Antichrist, including 20% of Republicans. Voters are split 44% to 45% on whether President Bush intentionally misled us about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. 72% of Democrats think Bush lied about WMDs. Independents agree 48 to 45%, but just 13% of Republicans think so. 29% of voters believe aliens exist and are visiting the Earth. 14% of voters say the CIA was instrumental in creating the crack cocaine epidemic in America's inner cities in the 1980s. 9% of voters think the government adds fluoride to our water supply for sinister reasons, not just dental health. 4% of voters say they believe lizard people control our societies by gaining political power. 51% of voters say a conspiracy was at work in the JFK assassination, whereas just 25% say Oswald acted alone. There seems to be a 4-5% floor for any conspiracy, no matter how bizarre. Those are the hardcore conspiracy theorists. There also appears to be some basic psychology at work. We tend to assume that big events must have big causes. It just doesn't sit right with us to think that a major world event with significant historical implications was pulled off by some lone nut job. That's partly why a majority of Americans still believe in a JFK conspiracy, even after 50 years with no real evidence coming to light to support it. There were similar conspiracy theories for decades following the Lincoln assassination. There remain conspiracy theories about the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. The psychology of conspiracy. Psychologists Veeran Swamy and Rebecca Coles reviewed conspiracy research in their 2010 article, The Truth Is Out There. They discuss how early papers on conspiracy theories focused on characterizing the theories themselves rather than the people who hold them. They reference Richard Hofstadter's seminal 1966 paper on conspiracy theories, in which he defined them as a belief in a, quote, vast, insidious, preternaturally effective international conspiratorial network designed to perpetrate acts of the most fiendish character. That sums it up nicely. But the more interesting work came later, when researchers began to explore the psychology of the people who hold conspiracy theories. In this area, ideas followed a typical historical pattern. At first, conspiracy thinking was seen as a form of psychopathology involving paranoid delusional ideation. More recently, conspiracy thinking is seen as fulfilling certain universal psychological needs, perhaps triggered by situational factors. In my view, both approaches are correct. There appears to be a spectrum of inherent predisposition to conspiracy thinking. There is, at the same time, a universal appeal to conspiracy theories and a type of situation in which they are more likely to occur, even among the more rational. For example, Swamy and Coles write, "To the extent that conspiracy theories fill a need for certainty, it is thought they may gain more widespread acceptance in instances when establishment or mainstream explanations contain erroneous information, discrepancies, or ambiguities." A conspiracy theory, in this sense, helps explain those ambiguities and, quote, provides a convenient alternative to living with uncertainty. Or, as Young and colleagues have put it, quote, "The human desire for explanations of all natural phenomena, a drive that spurs inquiry on many levels, aids the conspiracist in the quest for public acceptance." Conspiracy thinking is rooted in a desire for control and understanding, triggered by a lack of said control or ambiguous or unsatisfying information. The authors emphasize that the public often lacks access to adequate information to explain historical events, a situational factor. This can be coupled with what has been called a crippled epistemology, a tendency to utilize circular reasoning, confirmation bias, and poor logic coupled with this deficiency of information. The result is a popular conspiracy theory that makes sense, even if a perverse sense, of events. A 2016 study by Damaris Graupner and Alan Komen found that conspiracy thinking correlates with feelings of isolation and helplessness. This fits nicely with the notion that conspiracy theories are a pathological attempt to feel in control. The Sandy Hook Conspiracy. A recent grand conspiracy theory that displays many of the features I just discussed is the Sandy Hook Conspiracy. In December 2012, a disturbed young man decided it would be a good idea to go into an elementary school and slaughter young children. He killed his mother, 20 children, 6 teachers, and then himself. It was a horrific event for the families, for the town, and for our country. It was every parent's worst nightmare. The tragedy took place in Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. As it happens, my parents and brother Bob live in Newtown, not far from Sandy Hook. I also have friends who had children in the school, none hurt, thankfully, and one of those friends was at the school when the shooting took place. Her husband, also a friend, was one of the first responders and saw the bodies. The couple are close friends of my fellow rogue, Evan, who has known them since childhood. I was introduced to them more recently. I point all this out for a couple of probably obvious reasons. The first is that I have only one degree of separation from direct eyewitnesses. The second is to indicate that this is a small Connecticut town. There are hundreds of families, at least, with similar connections to the shooting. James Tracy, a professor of communications at Florida Atlantic University until he was dismissed in 2016, runs a conspiracy-mongering blog in which he calls into question the official story of what happened at Sandy Hook. In 2013, soon after the shooting, he was already raising conspiracy questions about its veracity. At the time, he was, quote, just asking questions. He has since progressed to harassing the families of victims. Tracy believes that the Sandy Hook massacre didn't occur the way the media has reported, and perhaps it didn't occur at all. He makes all the logical errors that conspiracy theorists make. One of his primary errors is to point to discrepancies in the way the media reported the details. As anyone who has paid attention to the media while a story is breaking has experienced, during a dramatic event, the media struggles to get out any tidbit of information as quickly as possible, and some of this preliminary reporting will later prove incorrect. This is evidence of the media fighting for ratings during an unfolding event, not evidence that the media is involved in a conspiracy to fabricate a story. Tracy's errors are an example of the anomaly hunting I discussed previously. In this case, the anomalies are discrepancies in media reporting, plus other extraneous details reported by the media before it was known what they meant. Any event such as this is bound to have many quirky details, and it will be difficult to explain every detail to an acceptable degree without specific knowledge. Strange coincidences will occur. There are just so many details in everyday life, and when a dramatic event suddenly draws attention to all those tiny details, we see all the apparent anomalies. For example, right after the shooting, when the police were securing the area, several individuals were encountered in the woods around the school. They all turned out to be either reporters hoping to get some photographs or locals just interested in the commotion. But to conspiracy theorists, they are evidence of a broader plot. Who were these people? Why exactly were they there? Why isn't there more detail in the police reports? In one on-camera interview, Robbie Parker, father of slain 6-year-old Emily Parker, seems to be smiling right before he addresses the camera, when he suddenly looks grief-stricken. To conspiracy theorists, this is evidence that he is a, quote, crisis actor, a term they made up. Those grieving a recent loss, however, can still exhibit a range of emotions, and no one knows what Parker was responding to before he stepped in front of the camera. The dramatic tragedy of these events in the context of our current media age causes most of the grieving families to protect their privacy. They don't want to be the target of media attention while they're trying to process a horrific loss. Tracy and other conspiracy theorists take this ordinary desire for privacy and interpret it as a cover-up. Ironically, conspiracy theorists can bring extremely negative attention to the families, increasing their desire for privacy, and then they use the privacy they help to motivate as evidence for a conspiracy. In addition to all the logical errors, theorists like Tracy, who interpret everyday events as if they were evidence of a deep, dark conspiracy, miss the big picture in such a dramatic way that it's difficult not to conclude they're divorced from reality. Think for just a minute what it would take to pull off such a conspiracy. The perpetrators would have to fake a mass shooting at an elementary school, pretending to kill 20 children and 7 adults who never existed. You would think someone in the town would notice. The entire community would have to be involved in the conspiracy. In fact, a significantly extended community would have to be involved. Evan and I would both have to be involved, and we live several towns over. The web of direct connections to the families of those killed is massive. I can't help but point out the flagrant journalistic failure of people like Tracy. He's defending himself as doing the type of investigation that any good journalist should. He is wrong for several reasons. First, as I just pointed out, his theory is absurd, and good journalists don't have to investigate every absurd theory that someone cooks up. Plausibility counts. Further, he's going about it in a clumsy and unethical way. He is harassing grieving families without any probable cause and without a lick of hard evidence to back him up. He has no evidence for a conspiracy, just misinterpreted anomaly hunting. A competent journalist, if they thought they had a story that needed investigating, would discreetly investigate public records. If they uncovered solid evidence that points to an actual conspiracy, then they might be justified in confronting those involved. Tracy has nothing. The Sandy Hook conspiracy goes beyond this one former professor. He was fired for this behavior in 2016. Radio host Alex Jones, who has made a name for himself as a conspiracy theorist, hosted a roundtable of Sandy Hook conspiracy theorists on his program. In clarifying his own position, he said, "I've always said I'm not sure about what really happened, that there's a lot of anomalies and there has been a cover-up of whatever did happen there. All I know is the official story of Sandy Hook has more holes in it than Swiss cheese." Alleged anomalies equals some cover-up, but he does not have to commit himself to anything specific. He then appeals to the ad hominem fallacy. We know the government lies, so they are probably lying about this. Others argue that since the government, under Obama, was using the incident to fight for gun control, they must have staged this incident to that end. Jones himself, while fighting a custody battle in 2017, used the defense that he is just a, quote, performance artist. He doesn't necessarily believe all the crazy conspiracies that he touts. Of course, that claim can just be another false flag. Once you're through the looking glass of conspiracy theories, the normal rules of evidence and logic don't apply. All you know is that nothing is what it seems. The only real protection is to understand conspiracy thinking as a phenomenon, to recognize its elements and control against them. This probably has to happen preventively, however. Once you really accept a conspiracy narrative, it's too late. Chapter 26. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Witch Hunts. A witch hunt is a dedicated and unjust investigation or prosecution of a person or group in which the extreme and threatening nature of the alleged crimes is used to justify suspending or ignoring the usual rules of evidence. Woman: I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch. Vladimir: Hey, but you are dressed as one. Woman: They dressed me up like this. All: Nah, no, we didn't know. Woman: And this isn't my nose, it's a false one. Vladimir lifts up carrot. Vladimir: Well? Person 1: Well, we did do the nose. Vladimir: The nose? Person 1: And the hat. But she is a witch. All: Yeah, burn her, burn her. Vladimir: Did you dress her up like this? Person 1: No, 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 no. Yes, yes, a bit. A bit. But she has got a wart. Scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In the spring of 1692, a number of young girls in Salem Village in the Massachusetts Bay Colony claimed that they were possessed by the devil and accused several women in the village of witchcraft. What should have been dismissed as a childhood prank was taken seriously by the authorities. Eventually, over 200 people were accused of witchcraft, and 19 were executed. But by the following year, popular opinion was turning against the trials. The remaining accused were set free, and the courts dissolved. By 1711, the judges who presided over the courts apologized publicly, and restitution was paid to the families of those who died. While this remains a painful episode in American history, it was a pinprick compared to the witch hysteria that gripped Europe for over four centuries. Highly conservative estimates of how many people were killed as witches between 1300 and 1700 in Europe range from 50 to 60,000. This is almost certainly an underestimate, however, with some estimates reaching the hundreds of thousands. The time frame is also a bit conservative, with witch hunting beginning before 1300 and ending after 1700. In 1487, the book that would become the Guide to Hunting Witches was published in Germany, the Malleus Maleficarum, Latin for the Hammer of Witches, Der Hexenhammer in German. The book was written by Heinrich Kramer and Jacob Sprenger, members of the Dominican Order of Inquisitors for the Catholic Church, and was intended to codify knowledge of witches and how to identify them. The book deals with such critical questions as whether witches may work some prestidigitatory illusion so that the male organ appears to be entirely removed and separate from the body. From our modern perspective, this is an almost comical example of the misogyny inherent in the witch hunts. It's easy to obtain a free electronic version of the Malleus, and I suggest that you do, and read at least some samples of the various chapters. It is stunning. Here's one example. And this is when the accused is not convicted of heresy by her own confession or by the evidence of the facts or by the legitimate productions of witnesses, but there are indications, not only light or even strong, but very strong and grave, which render her gravely suspected of the said heresy, and by reason of which she must be judged as one gravely suspected of the said heresy. In other words, even when there is no evidence that would ordinarily be accepted in court, such as confession, eyewitnesses, or hard evidence, the witch may still be guilty because of other more subtle, quote, indications. This could literally be anything. The book essentially outlines a method for using confirmation bias to prove suspicions. A witch hunt, as typified by the Malleus, and the literal European witch hunts has six parts. Accusation equals guilt. The very fact of being accused is enough to make someone suspect, and being suspect is enough to justify an investigation. Since the rules of evidence are so fluid and adaptable, the bar so low, any investigation will likely yield a positive result. Effectively, once accused, you are guilty. Suspension of the normal rules of evidence. Even in medieval times, people had some sense of what constituted actual compelling evidence. Courts sometimes applied reasonable standards. When the stakes were high, however, such as when an agent of the devil was suspected to be at work, then the normal rules of evidence were jettisoned. Losing one's temper or staring for a bit too long at someone would become sufficient evidence to be convicted of witchcraft. The coincidental death of a cow could be enough to justify burning the strange woman who lived at the edge of town. Allowing spectral evidence. The term spectral evidence refers to dreams and visions. There is, of course, nothing tangible to investigate, nor even actual events or other witnesses to corroborate. A vision exists entirely in the mind of a witness, without the possibility of external validation. Spectral evidence was specifically allowed in the Salem trials, but was later banned by colony law. Methods of investigation as bad as punishment or conviction. The Malleus directly recommends torture as an effective method of obtaining a confession. Essentially, once accused, your choice was to confess and be executed, or not confess and be tortured, often to death. Encouraging accusations. Those accused of being a witch would likely know other witches. Therefore, you could torture them for names or promise a lighter sentence for turning in others. This led to a chain reaction of accusations. Accusations used as a weapon. Once the rules of evidence are relaxed to such an extent, it becomes possible, even trivial, to use the Inquisition as a weapon. It can be used against political enemies, against business rivals, and against other outside groups. It can become a tool of persecuting marginalized members of society. This seemingly absurd logic has been translated into modern discourse. In 1996, philosopher Douglas Walton wrote a paper in which he described 10 features typical of a witch hunt-style argument. He wrote, "In this paper, 10 conditions are formulated as a cluster of properties characterizing the witch hunt as a framework in which arguments are used. 1. Pressure of social forces. 2. Stigmatization. 3. Climate of fear.